Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning we're going to continue to try to have some conversations exploring the implications of the terrorist attacks that took place in Washington and New York last week. We have a couple of topics lined up. Let me just again mention as we get our first guest hooked up that in the second part of the program we'll be talking about Pakistan and Afghanistan with two guests who've spent a lot of time following events in this part of the world. Stephen Cohen, who is now at the Brookings Institute and was for a long time professor of political science here, one of the people who started the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. Also, Mubin Shorish, who is an associate professor of education policy studies at University of Illinois and certainly has been following events in Afghanistan since the Russian invasion. We'll try to talk a little bit about the politics of Afghanistan, about the Taliban, who they are, the connections between the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, and also connections between Pakistan and Afghanistan. As you know, no doubt, the United States government asked the government of Pakistan to go and speak with the Taliban about the desire of the United States to have Osama bin Laden. That still seems to be the question exactly how that's going to play out. We'll try and talk about some of these things with the two of them in the second part of the program, so hope you can stick with us. Here in hour number one, we'll be talking about the relationship between the United States and Russia in the light of last week's events. And our guest is Mark Kramer. He's director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies. He's also a senior associate at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University, and he has taught at Harvard, Yale, and Brown universities. He has written a great many articles on a variety of topics, including the Cuban Missile Crisis, relations between the Soviet Union and China, the armed forces of the Soviet and post-Soviet era, and also about NATO and East European security, just to mention a few topics. He's also authored books on Czechoslovakia and the crisis there in 1968, on Soviet policy in East Central Europe, and is now editing a book on the collapse of the Soviet Union that's set to be published this year. He's expected to be here in Champaign-Urbana a little bit later this week to take part in a colloquium discussing Russia and Poland and the Soviet involvement in the Polish crisis of 1980-81. So people who are interested in that subject, you can look forward to that. That'll be taking place on Thursday. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to that he's going to be giving us some of his time. As we talk this morning with our guest, questions, of course, are welcome for people who are listening, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Kramer, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
No, good to be here.
The Russia has said that it supports the United States, will support the United States in its effort to deal with terrorism. Obviously, Russia has its own concerns about terrorism, so perhaps not surprising that they would, at least in terms of public posture, be supportive of the United States. What actually do you think the Russians can do, if there is anything that the Russians can do, to help the United States in this?
Yes. The Russia's position at the moment is still a little bit ambiguous. There seem to be different views within the Russian government. Russian President Vladimir Putin very promptly indicated that Russia would lend its support, and other senior Russian officials also spoke in a very cooperative way. Over the weekend, though, there was a comment by Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov, who is regarded as a hardliner in the Russian government, who said that Russia really wasn't very interested in cooperating in any military arrangement. In particular, he referred to Russian military bases and also indigenous military bases in Central Asia. So on the question of what Russia could provide, there are two major things that would help in any military operation vis-a-vis Afghanistan, assuming that that is what will take place. And I'll, for the sake of argument, I'll assume that. So the two things that Russia could provide would be intelligence, because it clearly has much better links in that area, being much nearer and also having long-standing ties with the Central Asian countries than the United States does. And second, it does have military facilities, including air bases and other military installations in Central Asia, particularly Tajikistan, which is one of the Central Asian countries bordering Afghanistan.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that Russia had experience in Afghanistan with trying to wage land war there, surely they could at least advise us, and it's possible that that honestly they might say, don't do it. What sort of advice do you think, just in terms of advice, would they be in a position to give the United States?
That's correct. Russia is facing conflicting pressures here because it is fighting its own insurgency against Chechnya. And it has claimed repeatedly, to some extent with some evidence, although I think some of this gets exaggerated, but it has claimed that some of the Chechen groups, at least, are linked with Osama bin Laden or have received support from Osama bin Laden. There are broader claims the Russian government has made as well about terrorism from Chechnya, and it is clearly seeking to link the incident in the United States in the American public mind with what's been going on Chechnya. On the other hand, Russia, or what was then the Soviet Union, had a very unpleasant experience in Afghanistan, beginning with an invasion in December of 1979 that led to a very bloody and ultimately futile war, and Soviet troops withdrew in February of 1989, a decade later, and basically having achieved nothing because Afghanistan was still mired in a civil war at that point, and that civil war has basically been going on to this day, even though the Taliban around 1996 gained control of most of the country. There are still fairly significant rebel groups that are operating. And Russia, therefore, is very well aware of how difficult it would be to conduct any type of counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan or to attack targets that are in that are in high mountainous areas and that are in desolate reaches where no roads go. So the Russians, I think, are going all in addition to whatever intelligence they can provide, will also be able to give a strong note of caution about getting involved in something that we may regret.
Mm-hmm. Just it's worth noting, perhaps, that just a couple of months ago, the Chinese leader Jiang Zemin was in Russia talking with Mr. Putin, and that they signed an agreement between Russia and China. And that I'm not sure how much notice people took of this. I'm sure people who study diplomacy took notice. But apparently one of the things that motivated that this new pact between Russia and China was indeed concern about nationalist movements based in some of the republics or former republics of the Soviet Union in their east, and then also on the Chinese part, nationalist in their west.
Yes,
that they now have this sort of common thing that draws them together.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Is in addition to the bilateral agreement between Russia and China, there was a separate agreement, the so-called Shanghai Six agreement, that included some of the Central Asian countries, most of the Central Asian countries as well. The Central Asian countries that had once been part of the Soviet Union, and most of which is still very closely tied to Russia. And the aim of both pacts, the bilateral one and then the larger one, was to counter fundamentalist Islam and some of the more radical groups that have, for the most part, been tied to either the Taliban or, in some cases, to Iran or other states nearby. But the country that's been of greatest concern is Afghanistan and the ruling Taliban there, because they clearly have provided assistance, material assistance and organizational assistance and territorial assistance to a lot of the groups. China, for example, which does have a very small area, does border on Afghanistan, the far northeast tip of Afghanistan, has its own problems right in that vicinity with Xinjiang province, where there is a fairly active separatist movement that the Chinese at least have claimed is linked or has received support from Osama bin Laden. So there definitely is a lot of nervousness on the part of states in the region. The Central Asian countries as well, particularly Uzbekistan, are faced with Islamic fundamentalists whom they deem to be a threat to their country's future. And it's created a lot of nervousness that I think has provided the basis for cooperation with the United States in this instance, even though there's also a lot of wariness of what U.S. intentions might be.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mark Kramer. He's director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies at Harvard University. He's also a senior associate at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard and is editor of the Journal of Cold War Studies. We're talking this morning a bit about the relationship between Russia and the United States in light of last week's events. I should give you a heads up, too, that we are told that President Bush is going to be making a statement this morning, and we'll have live coverage. We think it'll happen about 10:30, but of course, as these things go, we don't know when it might happen. I'm assuming that it will be brief, and we'll do that, and then we can resume our conversation. So just to let you know, Professor Kramer, what exactly it is we think might be happening.
Sure.
And also, of course, to people who are listening, questions are welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. The president has said that the effort to stop terrorism now will be the focus of his administration. And it has been observed that perhaps the last time that any single issue certainly was the focus of American foreign policy, that issue was the Cold War.
Right.
And we know just how much that shaped policy in this country on all levels. It seeped into almost every corner, even in popular culture. And I wonder whether you, being now a student of the Cold War, I wonder whether, in fact, you think that what is now being called the War on Terrorism will have effects as far-reaching as did the Cold War.
Yes, that's a very interesting question, and it's one that I've thought a bit about recently with that very parallel in mind, is the way the Cold War shaped life in the United States, often for the worse, unfortunately, even though that's not to say that the steps should not have been taken. I think in many instances there was a justification for them, but there's no question that we sacrificed a considerable amount in terms of civil liberties in this country as a result of the Cold War, the security precautions that were taken, at certain times grossly excessive, and were eventually struck down by the Supreme Court. But even with the measures that were allowed to persist, civil liberties, I think, were much narrower or certainly more constrained as a result of the Cold War than they would have been if there hadn't been that threat. And I suspect, unfortunately, that the same sort of thing may occur here, where there will be some infringements on civil liberties that will be an unfortunate but justifiable necessity, but there may be others that I think will go well beyond what is warranted. I can give a quick example of that. In 1996, in response to both the Oklahoma City bombing the previous year and the downing of TWA Flight 800, which turned out not to be terrorist-related, but was thought to be initially. And in response to that, there was a bill passed called the Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that contained a large number of measures that I thought had no benefit by way of the battle against terrorism, but did curtail civil liberties. And I'm worried that there will be some sort of measures adopted here as well that will restrict our civil liberties in a way that's not beneficial to the war on terrorism. Now, in addition, you mentioned about culture, and that, too, I think is an interesting topic to look at in how it was affected by the Cold War. And there's no question that American culture, both pop culture and high culture, were affected by the Cold War. I think it's inevitable that this event, given how traumatic and terrible it was, will have an indelible effect on American culture, not only movies, since this whole thing seemed like a movie to many of us watching it, and we were wondering when the film projector was going to be turned off, or hoping it would be, but also in more generally, I think it will be the reference point for many artistic works and things we see on television and film.
It certainly seems to be the case, particularly in the early years of the Cold War, that there was this feeling of of looming threat, and that it was something that was talked about in very literal terms in politics, as people talked about the Soviet Union, but also in popular culture in many veiled sorts of ways. Something,
yes,
that then, when we, as we got further and sort of further and further, say, into the Cold War or closer to the end of it, those sorts of things seemed to dissipate. Maybe easier to see them dissipating from the point of the perspective of the end, looking back. But one wonders whether indeed that sort of thing, that feeling of this vague sense of being threatened. And now here the additional element of not really knowing where the threat comes from precisely. It's before we could have pointed at Moscow and said, all right, this is it. But now the threat seems to be much more diffuse. And I guess I would expect that to bump up the general anxiety level even more, just for that very reason, that you can't tell precisely where that threat's likely to come from.
Yes, yes, there's no question of that the threat was very palpable during the Cold War. It was the Soviet Union and later China and certain other communist countries. But it in that sense was an easier one to know what we wanted to protect ourselves against. In this particular instance, exactly as you say, it's so ambiguous what is carrying out, who is carrying out these acts, and how you contend with someone like that, that it does have a much more diffuse impact on the culture, or it gives a more diffuse sense of threat. And the problem here as well, I think, is compared to the Cold War, when it was thought there were subversives in this country and there were certain measures implemented, many of them wholly unwarranted, and fortunately most of the ones that were unwarranted were struck down by the Supreme Court, but that were passed to contend with that threat. In this particular instance, the tragic reality is that there were people living in this country for quite some time who in fact carried out these acts, and that's what I think may make this even more frightening, is it was people among us who did this, even if they were sponsored and supported from abroad.
Just one of the most recent sort of bones of going back to the relationship between U.S. and Soviet Union, one of the most recent bones of contention was the stated intention by the United States to build a missile defense system. And I'm sure that now people who were raising questions about the appropriateness of that before would do it again and hasten to say that even if we had a missile defense system, it wouldn't have prevented the kinds of acts that took place last week. Having said that, though, one expects that there will be a lot of talk about, in various sorts of ways, about building up American defense.
Right.
So, and I wonder how you think that perhaps the whole discussion about missile defense fits into that, and then what that means for, again, the relationship here between Russia and the United States, because we were at this kind of rocky point where we were trying to persuade the Russians to go along and say that they thought it was okay what we were doing, and at the same time saying, well, we were pretty much going to do it anyway, whether they liked it or not, but we were hoping that they could accommodate themselves to it. How does what happened last week, or does that have any sort of fallout for this whole talk about missile defense?
Well, I suspect that just given the expenditures that are going to be needed on other items, I suspect that some of the funding that the administration was hoping to allocate to missile defense is not going to be available for a while. And in addition, the debate on that matter now seems almost, I don't want to say trivial, but it seems really arcane as compared to the very vivid threat that we confronted last week. And it's not to say that the prospect of a rogue state like Iraq or Iran acquiring a ballistic missile in the future that could reach the United States is implausible, because they will eventually, at some point in the future, have that capacity. But whether that's the primary threat we need to focus on now, I think, is seems far more, it seems a far more distant threat than it did last week. And I suspect that the debate over missile defense will shift now toward focusing on a much smaller system that would defend against what could be seen as a terrorist attack rather than the larger attack that the administration seemed to have in mind. But beyond that, though, I just think that that issue will be eclipsed by some of the other things that need to be done, particularly by way of improving airport security, improving air defenses, bolstering the security of systems that are designed to respond to emergencies. There was clearly a lack of preparedness, a really horrendous lack of preparedness for these sorts of incidents, even though there had been warnings of this type of thing for some time. And again, I don't want to fault people entirely for not having been prepared, because there were warnings about a lot of things, and there's only so much you can prepare for. But still, there were elementary security precautions that, if they had been in place, possibly could have thwarted these acts.
It seems to be the case that this was, while I'm sure that people who think about the possibility of terrorist attacks go through every scenario that they could possibly imagine, that this was one that seemed for a lot of people to be difficult to imagine.
Correct. That particularly because of the coordination involved in it, just to have four hijackings occur in such a remarkably compressed period of time requires enormous degree of coordination that most smaller terrorist organizations just couldn't have pulled off. And, I mean, the last time that there was something comparable to this was 30 years ago this month during the so-called Black September crisis in Jordan. And there were, in a single day then, the 6th of September, though, not the 11th, there were four planes hijacked, all by groups connected with radical Palestinian terrorists who were seeking to have the King of Jordan overthrown. And that's really the last comparable thing to this in terms of just the sheer scope of it, the coordination involved. There have been many other terrorist incidents in the interim, but this type of thing, I think, is not the sort of item that would be at the top of the list to defend against, just because it's so hard to pull off.
Yeah. We are at our midpoint here in this first hour of Focus 580. I'd just like to introduce once again our guest. We're speaking with Mark Kramer. He's director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies and a senior associate at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard. He has taught a number of places, including Harvard and Yale. He's written many articles on a variety of topics, including the Soviet and post-Soviet military, NATO and East European security, the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's written books on the crisis in Czechoslovakia in 1968, on Soviet policy in East Central Europe in the post-Cold War period. He's now editing a book on the collapse of the Soviet Union, scheduled to come out sometime this year. He's also scheduled to be on the campus of the University of Illinois on Thursday to talk about the Soviet Union and the Polish crisis of 80-81. So if you're interested in that topic, you can certainly stop by his talk at 4 in the afternoon in the International Studies Building. And he's joining us this morning by telephone from Harvard. So questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And I think it's possible we might be getting ready here to go to NPR for the statement by the president. But again, we're not really quite sure. So we'll continue our conversation. And if needs be, we can break away and then we can resume. Well, one of the very striking things that's taken place here in the past few days is that the NATO, United States went to NATO and invoked this element of the NATO charter, this article number 5, which is the one that says we consider an attack on one NATO member to be an attack on everyone. It's never been invoked before.
Right.
Just how significant is this, and what does that mean?
Yes, that was the great success of NATO during the Cold War, was that it never had to be called into action. In fact, the first time that NATO did act as an organization was in Kosovo in 1999, And that did not require invocation of Article 5, the self-defense clause, the mutual defense clause. The fact that this has been invoked now, I think, is in part symbolic to indicate the solidarity of the alliance in the war against terrorism. And it's not to say that there's a complete unity of views, but you do have very strong support for the United States in this instance. There's an awareness that some sort of action has to be taken. But beyond that, it does also suggest that there are going to be several of the NATO countries, particularly Britain, Canada, and Germany, that will contribute to a military operation. And that is important in gaining UN acceptance of it and bringing in countries, particularly from the Islamic world, who will be willing to take part. And if that is successful, and I know that there's a full-steam effort underway within the administration to put together a coalition of this sort, then that will greatly facilitate any sort of military operation that's undertaken.
Mm. Do you think that it would be likely that our NATO allies, I think that I did hear that the government of Italy, for example, said that they were willing to commit troops to some kind of effort. I guess I would expect that the British, since yes. they have fairly consistently at almost everything supported us. But can one imagine that some of the other countries in NATO might actually be willing to commit troops to an effort like this if we were really talking about going to war?
Oh, I do expect that most, in fact, the large majority of NATO countries will contribute at least small contingents of troops. There have been a significant number that have already indicated their willingness, in addition to Italy and certainly Britain. Tony Blair has been outspoken in his willingness to commit British troops. But also Germany, the three newest members, particularly Poland, as well as Hungary and the Czech Republic, have indicated their willingness to. Several other members as well. So I do expect it to have a large contribution. Large in the sense of symbolically, particularly, but also it will make a military difference from the NATO countries. It will be extremely important, though, to get cooperation from some of the Islamic countries, and that's where I think the diplomacy is going to be a lot trickier, although I do think it can be done, and I think that someone like Colin Powell does have the ability to pull it off. But that's the type of thing where if the United States can get access to bases in Central Asia and in the Middle East, then that is going to make this thing a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly, I would imagine that when we talk about who might support the United States and how might they support the United States, that hardware for the United States is not an issue. That we have tanks and planes and ships and so forth. That's not really what we would need.
Right.
What we would need perhaps would be intelligence, would be logistical support, possibly, as you say, a basis from which to operate. But it would seem that the most important thing would, in a sense, be moral support. That is, having governments say to the United States, yes, we support whatever action you take.
Right. There's no question that intelligence will be very important. That's where the Russians can play a big role, but there's a role for other countries in that as well, especially the Central Asian countries. Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, all used to be republics of the Soviet Union, but they are extremely important now because they all border on Afghanistan and all do have, within their own countries, within their own territory, they do have people of Afghan ethnic origin. There are, within Afghanistan as well, people of ethnic origin from these countries. There are Uzbeks there, there are Tajiks, Turkmens. Afghanistan is extremely diverse has a very diverse ethnic makeup. And it means that there are a lot of cross-border ties between these countries, and the role of intelligence there will be particularly important. It does mean, though, that there may be some reluctance on the part of the governments in Central Asia to give an unrestricted writ to the United States. They'll want to have a pretty clear idea, I think, in advance of what sort of military operation is envisaged, because they don't want it to be endless destruction of the sort that the Soviet Union conducted there in from 1979 to 1989. They don't want particularly the huge flood of refugees that came out of Afghanistan during that war and that overwhelmed the economies of some of the neighboring countries, especially Pakistan. So there's a good deal of wariness, but I still think it's possible that these countries can be brought on board and will offer afford something that will be feasible. One other country I should mention is India, which has already indicated its willingness to permit the United States to use bases. That's not that surprising in the sense that India is very hostile to the Taliban. There have been terrorist acts committed in India that were sponsored or at least linked to the Taliban. So it's not that surprising, but India, although separated by Pakistan from Afghanistan, is pretty close and would, again, have very good intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think you would expect that the Indians are interested in trying to repair diplomatic relations with the United States that have been strained ever since their nuclear tests a number of years ago.
That's correct. And U.S.-Indian ties have improved very rapidly this year already. There's been what I regard as quite a surprisingly fast improvement of relations between the two, and the Indians perhaps last year would not have been as ready to have their bases used, but this year clearly are.
We're interested in questions, comments from people who are listening. We're approaching our last 15 minutes. Our guest, Mark Kramer, director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies. We have two numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here on our toll-free line from southeastern Illinois on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yes, something that makes the coalition a lot easier is the fact that this Twin Towers Trade Center was almost, from a financial standpoint, a United Nations. There were many, many countries that had financial offices in those buildings, and I heard this morning that 62 nations lost people in that attack, including the Pakistanis. So, this has probably been appearing in local papers of the citizens in the individual countries that were lost.
Yes, no, that's a good point, that there were, in addition to thousands of Americans killed in these attacks, there were hundreds and hundreds of foreign citizens. The Mexicans, I think, had the largest total with over 500, but there were many other countries, as you said, over 60 countries that lost people here, including many of the Islamic countries had citizens who were killed there. And that does, again, I think, create a greater sense of solidarity behind the United States than there might have been if this had been something like the Oklahoma City bombing where it was just Americans who were killed.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I just read an article in the Boston Globe a couple of days ago, and it mentions how many war criminals and our terrorists are harbored in the U.S. There are a lot of Haitians. And then there's the case of Hector Gramajo, who was actually harbored by the JFK school for a while. I don't know if you've been around long enough to remember the agitation around that. He was going to be sued by an Alien Tort Act and left the country, and the suit did not go ahead, apparently, for some reason or other. So what I'm pointing at is we've employed the U.S., that is, not we as American people, but the U.S. government has employed terrorists for quite a while, and we actually have given a sucker and are harboring them. So we ought to clean up some of our own backyard, I think. I know that's heretical, and it's...
Well, again, I certainly would be the last to claim that U.S. policy has been perfect or flawless, but having said that, though, I don't really see the connection between this and the terrible attacks that occurred last week or see that they in any way mitigate the horror that anyone should feel about them.
Well, 30,000 people in Nicaragua, a lot of them in so-called soft targets. The Trade Center, I guess you could say, is a soft target by the U.S. definition. I'm just calling for some kind of
But let me the logic of it, I don't think holds up in the sense that because of some act by the U.S. government that it justifies the killing of thousands of innocent people.
You don't smell some hypocrisy here, though? The U.S. government, its policy has been to kill innocent people in quite a few places around the world. I'm not justifying terrorism. I'm just saying that we ought to call it what it is. Another thing that came up, and hasn't been discussed much, but even from the point of view of a strategist who wants to go into Afghanistan, the CIA trained these people. They were on the ground. They have assets. There were special forces that know the ground very well. Yesterday on Fresh Air out of Philadelphia, the fellow that did the PBS program for on Osama bin Laden, who's doing another one, he was perfectly willing to talk about the CIA training, but that wasn't...
No question. The CIA did provide training via Pakistan for...
$3 billion worth of...
The rebel groups in Afghanistan. They were at that point defending their country against the Soviet invasion. It was a quite different setting from what occurred after. The real problem has been through Pakistan, which created the Taliban, set them up and continue to this day to be crucial in the existence of the Taliban, because if Pakistan were to withdraw its support, its military support as well as financial support for the Taliban, the Taliban would be gone quickly.
I'm about $48 million worth of so-called anti-drug funds to the Taliban in the last 60 days or so, in this last quarter at least, and that's a big joke. I mean, this was another CIA operation that used a lot of drug money to fund it. What I'm saying is that
the United States has
done
good
war, but these people were still trained in anti-personnel and terrorist activities. And the reason why India is coming aboard is come as some of this blowback from the trained Mujahideen are now in Kashmir, and they're fighting on against Indian troops in Kashmir. So this should also be seen for what it is. I realize this is all heretical. It's beyond the pale. You can't talk about this.
Well, I've heard
in any way of justifying.
I still don't accept them, though. They don't strike me as lending any justification or reason to accept or in any way to believe as a tolerable thing what occurred in New York.
Did I say that I was trying to justify that? I am not. I'm just saying the U.S. government employed terror as a policy around the world.
And I don't understand what you're commenting about these particular events of last week. I mean, you can make those comments, and we could have another session about that, but that's not what we're talking about.
Hypocrisy is what it is. It's total hypocrisy.
On the part of whom? The people who were killed?
The government. I am not attacking the people that died. I am not attacking them at all. You keep trying to change this.
All government
justification for that action. It is not.
If you think that hypocrisy in politics is limited to the United States, then I would suggest you live overseas for a while, because you'll find that hypocrisy is rife in all of international politics.
In a large way, too.
Well, that, I guess the caller's done. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're speaking with Mark Kramer. He's director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies. He's also a senior associate at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard. He's planning on being on the campus later this week to talk about something rather different as part of a colloquium lecture on directions in Russian and East European studies. And that'll be Thursday afternoon. We were going to have him here on the program this morning actually to talk about relations between Russia and the United States, and we thought we would do that, but do it in light of what happened last week with the attacks on New York and Washington. Questions are welcome. All we ask is people try to be brief in making their comments just so we can keep things moving along and try to get in as many different people as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free line, go to anywhere that you can hear us, is 800-222-9455. I think we're getting some other folks lined up here. And again, we're thinking that maybe sometime this morning we're going to have live coverage of a statement by the president. First, we thought maybe about 10:30, and now I guess we're just not sure. But again, when and if that happens, and if National Public Radio provides us coverage, we will bring it to you. And if that means interrupting what we're doing, then indeed that's what we'll do. Let's continue here. We have some other callers, and next up is Champagne here. It's line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate your caller being willing to reply to the gentleman who just called, because it seems there's a certain segment of the population that feels so much self-loathing that they want to blame this terrible event on the United States. Whereas I admit that we've made mistakes, but so many people were hurt so badly, and in fact the whole country was violated, that we have to remember that. And it doesn't justify our past acts, but we do have a right as a sovereign state to reply to this attack. And I just appreciate your guest for kind of pointing that out to the other gentleman. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's just, what do you say we just go on here? We have another caller in Savoy. That's line 3. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, you know, I've been watching all this coverage and everything we've been listening to.
We're just, pardon me for interrupting you, caller, but I think we've just been given the heads up that we're about to, in a minute or so, we're about to go to the president. So rather than have to interrupt you when you get even further into your comment, I think we're going to have to ask you to hold on.
Hey, I'll tell you what, we'll catch you some other time.
All right, that's great.
All right, bye.
As we said a little bit earlier, we were thinking that there would be a statement from the president this morning, a live statement. We're not exactly sure what he plans to cover, but we're going to bring it to you right now. We're going to National Public Radio.
Gilmore and Mrs. Pataki.
Please be seated. Welcome. Last week, America suffered greatly. Thousands of our citizens lost lives. Thousands were hurt. But thousands of our citizens rose to the occasion to help. Last week was a really horrible week for America. But out of our tears and sadness, we saw the best of America as well. We saw a great country rise up to help. Tens of millions of dollars and thousands of hours and tons of food and clothing have all been donated to help rebuild shattered lives. Americans' love for America was channeled through our nation's great charities. And as president of this great land, nothing made me more proud. In the weeks since the attack, our compassion and generous citizens have led the first phase in the war on terrorism. They have sustained and strengthened the home front. Today, I'm joined by representatives of charities which have brought relief to citizens in New York City and Virginia and Pennsylvania. We've got representatives of firefighters, police officers, entrepreneurs who've helped out all across America. Got many good citizens here who represent the large national charities, like the American Red Cross, the Salvation Army, and the United Way. We've got folks here in the nation's Rose Garden who represent the community-based programs and faith-based programs, firefighter and police associations, local businesses, nonprofits. Large and small, these important charitable efforts are saving lives and, as importantly, are restoring hope. I'm also joined by Libby Pataki, the better half of the governor of New York. Tony Carbonetti, the chief of staff to Rudy Giuliani. And my friends and former fellow governors, actually they're governors, I was a former governor, Jim Gilmore and Tom Ridge. These governors and their wives and the mayor of New York have shown impressive leadership in the face of the challenges that face their cities and their states. They put public agencies on full alert to provide immediate assistance to victims and their families, and for all those who helped, our nation is most grateful. They've called on the men and women of the National Guard to help maintain calm and order. And we thank those who wear the uniform as well. And they've led and supported valiant rescue workers in New York City and Northern Virginia, whose bravery is seared into our national consciousness. I was honored to be able to stand amidst the rescue workers and looked in their eyes and saw the determination that would make all Americans proud, in spite of their exhaustion, in spite of the fact that they had worked themselves into a state of total fatigue. They still wanted to keep fighting on for their fellow brothers and sisters trapped in the rubble. Mayor Giuliani and Pataki have led New York City through its most difficult of all days, and they have done so with class and bravery and distinction, and we owe them a debt of gratitude. The mayor, the governors, all New Yorkers have demonstrated the very best American values to a world that has been watching to see how our nation would react. The world watches the great country called America, and they say, what will they do? What will Americans do? And what they have seen the best of America. They've seen leadership, they've seen courage, and as importantly, they've seen compassion. Last evening marked the start of Rosh Hashanah, and Jewish teaching this holy day is the anniversary of the creation of the world. It is a season of renewal and of hope. And people of every faith all across America embrace that spirit of renewal and hope. Funds in New York and Washington are providing food, clothing, and financial help to husbands and wives and sons and daughters who suffer mightily. Citizens near Ground Zero in New York have provided sandwiches, drinks, and clean clothes to the tired and hungry rescue workers. And in one of America's greatest traditions, a handful of entrepreneurs from Springfield, Virginia, collected $600 by selling lemonade and gave it to the Red Cross. These acts of generosity and kindness are spreading all across America. There are challenges that remain for those who suffer today. Make no mistake about it. We've got a lot of work to do as a nation. And these good efforts, these good charitable, compassionate efforts, need the full support of Americans everywhere. People all across the country are asking how they can help. What can they do to provide hope? What can they do to help heal the wounds and help by helping their fellow Americans? Well, there are many ways to contribute. Local stores and businesses on Main Street America are collecting money to send to appropriate relief and help agencies. National media organizations are helping collect. Internet portals are providing an interesting opportunity for people to contribute and provide their help. Many of the charities themselves welcome donations through websites. So I urge my fellow Americans to continue contributing through websites. If you're interested in helping, call up one of the great charities of America and contribute. Thus far, I'm proud to report through the websites of our charities, Americans have donated $55 million in 7 short days. Some Americans, high-tech leaders, AOL, Time Warner, and Microsoft, Amazon, eBay, Cisco Systems, and Yahoo, have joined together in a private effort to encourage online giving so that we can funnel in resources to help our citizens in need. They have formed what's called the American Liberty Partnership. It has a website called libertyunites.org. And this will help Americans find out how to help. If a concerned American wants to help a neighbor in need, even though the neighborhood might not be right next to each other. They can get on libertyunites.org and find out how to help. And I urge my fellow Americans to do so. Americans can not only make online donations, they can figure out where to send food, where to donate blood, where to give clothes. They can find out how best to donate their time. Now, it's important to realize that at this moment, many of our charities are overwhelmed by the public response. That's the kind of problem we like in America. But because the portals may be jammed, because the phones may be busy, is not an excuse for Americans not to continue to fight to help their neighbors. And so I ask my fellow Americans to be patient with those charities that want their help, to keep trying to give, to not lose sight of the mission, and that is we'll fight terrorism on all fronts. We will not be terrorized so that our hearts are hardened. Nobody can threaten this country. Oh, they may be able to bomb up buildings and obviously disrupt lives, but we're too great a nation to allow the evildoers to affect our soul and our spirit. Today, I herald the soul and spirit of America with live examples of people who made a huge difference in those who suffer and those who hurt. It's a great land. It's a great land because our people are so decent and strong and compassionate. God bless.
President Bush in the Rose Garden of the White House telling Americans what they can do to help with relief efforts in the aftermath of last week's terrorist attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center in New York City. NPR's special coverage continues in a few moments with Neil Conan. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Bob Edwards.